The Savvy Traveler is produced in Los Angeles by Minnesota Public Radio in association with the University of Southern California. On the web at savvytraveler.org.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Savvy Traveler. I'm Diana Nyad. If the threat of war and soaring fuel prices hadn't put enough of a damper on airline travel this week, Mother Nature just had to jump in and add to the mess. We'll talk about coping with weather delays as you travel in a minute. And yes, on the face of it, it's not an ideal time to travel. But if there ever was a time to dig through your local newspaper's Sunday travel section, this is it. If you're on the fence as to whether or not to travel over upcoming months, some of the knockout fares might push you over the edge and get you packing. Cooking schools in France, cruises through the Panama Canal, romantic getaways to Vancouver, trips that might have been lifetime dreams just a couple of years ago are now totally affordable. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to post a sampling of a few great newspaper travel sections, as well as links to some of the best travel discount internet sites on our website, savvytraveler.org. Bon voyage. But what do you say we get traveling ourselves today? Bob Duskus is our savvy international music guide. He co-founded the Six Degrees label up in San Francisco. Now, he travels the world in search of both new and old sounds and takes us traveling with him by introducing us to the music he finds. We're happy to welcome Bob Duskus back to the show. How have you been, Bob?
I have been well, Diana. How about yourself?
Well, I've been great. Where are we going today?
Well, we're going actually someplace very exotic to start off with today. We're going to Uzbekistan, and the woman that we're going to be listening to today is called Sivara Nazarkhan. And she's actually a young woman. She's 25 years old, and she's known in Uzbekistan as a pop singer, as a pop star. But for this particular project, which is called Yol Bolsin, which means, where are you going? She's sort of taking down the mantle of poppiness and taking on peasant songs and ancient songs, Sufi melodies. And she's got a fantastic collaborator on this record, Diana, a French-Algerian by the name of Hector Zazu, who is one of my absolute favorite musicians and producers. And he brings the slight modern and atmospheric textures to this record, which take it beyond the ordinary, and it's not just a bunch of old folk songs. It's got just a little bit of a haunting electronic ambient stamp to it as well.
Yeah, well, you set the scene so well. Let's hear it a little bit.
It's a beautiful sound. The primary instrument that you hear Nazarkhan playing is called a dutar, and it is a 15th century two-stringed lute instrument.
No kidding.
And the song we're listening to is called Yor Yor, and it's actually a traditional song to a bride about moving into the home of her husband for the first time. And what's interesting about a lot of these folk tunes is they're meant to be improvised. The lyrics are meant to be changed every time they're sung, and the story is meant to be given a little bit of a twist each time a different singer sings it. So that's what Sivara is bringing to this particular track right now.
I see. So it's sort of like a oral history that comes down, and each singer can do what they want with it.
Absolutely.
You know, it's so funny, Bob. Of course, you know, I have no idea what they're singing about, but just for you to tell us that she is singing about, you know, an old, centuries-old story of moving into the new husband's home, et cetera, it's now all of a sudden I'm painting an entire picture to her and her life and the old world of Uzbekistan.
You get to get the images. Yeah, I think it's very interesting when you hear things in context like that. Just one more real quick interesting fact about folk music and the old music of Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
Unlike any kind of parallel here in the States, this ancient music actually is still a very much a part of modern life. And people sing these songs at parties. They're played on pop radio right next to Britney Spears songs. And it's just a very living cultural thing. And it's something that I think is a very interesting phenomenon out there.
Let's remind people the name of the album.
The singer's name is Sivara Nazarkhan, and the record is called Yol Bolsin.
All right, fantastic. Well, that was a totally brand new territory for me, for sure. Thank you. Where else? We taking a second trip today?
Yeah, we're going to Cuba by way of Africa and now here in the Bay Area from a singer that's on my label, Six Degrees Records, whose name is Bobby Cespedes. Bobby was born in Cuba, stayed there until she was a young woman and moved to the States in 1959. She has been well known, well regarded sort of in world music circles for a large band that she sung with called Conjunto Cespedes, a 12-piece Afro-Cuban ensemble that's rather traditional. But this is the first time that she's done a solo record as a leader, and it's a very different direction for her because Bobby loves the old Afro-Cuban music, but she also loves Motown, and she also loves the thump of hip-hop that comes out of the East Bay in Oakland where she lives. And so she and her producer, Greg Landau, have enlisted the aid of some modern hip-hop drum program. And what you've got is this fascinating combination of Afro-Cuban rhythms and modern hip-hop and just a little bit of a modern drum dance group.
What's this one called?
This is called Rezos. It's actually the title track. It means prayers. It's very interesting because Bobby is also a priestess in the Yoruban Lukumi tradition. And as the priestess, she is responsible in that religion's tradition for leading the call and response chants that are actually communicating with the Orisha, who are the Yoruban deities. So this music actually is, in some part, prayer mixed with this modern groove. This next track we have is called California, and it actually is a little more lighthearted than some of the other things in the record. It's based on her mother's, as she says, recollections of coming to California for the first time from Cuba. And as you can hear, it's kind of got a very big and up celebratory sound to it.
That's fabulous. I really love her. Bobby Cespedes.
Bobby says about this track that she wanted to express her own view of California, filtered through her own culture and experiences.
All right, Bob Duskus, I thank you so much. Our Savvy Traveler Guide to the World of Music, co-founder of Six Degrees Records. Bob, we'll check back with you in a couple of weeks and get a few more wonderful tunes from you.
Thanks, Diana.
I'm sitting in the Savvy Traveler studio across from an English author named Jeff Dyer. I'm sure you know Jeff. He's written a number of wonderful books over the years. Paris Trance may ring a bell, Out of Sheer Rage, and his new book, Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It. Sounds like self-help. It's not. Sounds like a travel book. He goes all over the world in this book, but it's not specifically. Sounds like humor, and it is, and then it's not. Jeff Dyer, welcome, first of all.
Hi, thanks very much.
Well, let's start with the, you know, you go to all these, you know, vastly different places. I mean, we're traveling from Miami to Cambodia to Detroit, of all places, to Thailand, to Rome, Paris. And one of your phrases when you're in Rome, the only place, how does it go?
Oh, it's something, I'm there on one of the big national holidays when it's completely deserted. And it's so deserted, I say something like, I'd really like to get in a car and go somewhere. But the only place I wanted to go to is Rome. And I'm there already.
And that is this sort of existential zeitgeist of the entire book. You're immersed everywhere, and then you're really not doing anything anywhere.
Yeah, it depends, actually. I mean, some of the places I go to for a relatively short visit on assignment. On the other hand, the Rome section of the book, well, that's based on three long summers that I spent in Rome. And I talk constantly in the book about this thing where you're ostensibly doing nothing, but then in retrospect, actually, it turns out that during that phase where you haven't really accomplished anything, in fact, in all sorts of ways, the spirit of the place has got under your skin, and you've had quite an intense relation with the people and a great responsiveness to what's going on around you.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with Rome. I mean, I've never heard a description of a huge city as you make during this holiday absolutely empty. I mean, there wasn't a soul in the place.
There's one day, Ferragosto, which is the 15th of August, I guess, and everybody just disappears, and it was unbelievably hot. So even the few people who were there, they were indoors, like the shadows. And yeah, it was just a wonderful thing, like wandering around a city after there'd been some kind of apocalyptic event which had wiped out all of, which had vaporized the entire population.
That's the image you've got going. That's just what I pictured.
I mean, I kind of like that, because also when it's incredibly hot and incredibly still, i.e. there's no wind, well, then you get this weird sense that maybe there's no time either. So you're walking through this place, which of course has got all this incredible amount of history, all these different layers of different sort of architectural styles, different ruins, that kind of stuff. And it really did seem, oh, time has absolutely stopped, and I'm the last person on Earth. It really, yeah, it really did have that spooky feel to it.
You know, you talk about the ruins, for instance, with some passion. I mean, I see, you know, there's an animation to you. And as I read through all your chapters, I have a definite visual image of the place. On the other hand, you know, you've been labeled such a, what is it, counter-tourist. Mm. You refuse to, you know, see the big icon sites of places. But you are impressed visually and culturally with the places, aren't you?
Yeah, and I've certainly done a lot of, you know, straightforward tourism in my time. And I think there's a lot of stuff about ruins in the book because, I mean, they're just incredible places. And what struck me really at a place like Leptis Magna in Libya, which is one of the great ruins of classical antiquity, is that maybe Leptis Magna is at its greatest now. It's not that it was this splendid, incredible monument which then fell into disrepair and became less good. In some weird way, many of these places achieve their apotheosis as ruins. So then I go on to build this kind of not entirely serious sort of riff on the idea that maybe there's something in buildings and people that aspires to ruination. And that uh-huh. provides another link with the book, which is to say that whereas at one stage I had an idea of writing a book about the ruins of classical antiquity in Rome, that didn't happen. And all that remains in this book is the ruins of that previous intention. Why did that happen? Well, because the author himself fell into ruin.
The author was in decline as well.
Yeah, in decline and fall, to borrow Gibbon's phrase.
Yeah. You know, Jeff, you know, the joke is that you're doing nothing, but as a writer, is there some discipline in your day to writing? And really, what's the goal? Are you just there to soak it up, just to observe and mix in with all the strangers and the locals you can?
It depends. Sometimes I've gone to places, as it were, on assignment, and then that has the great advantage that you know you've got to write something about a place. So you go in a state of absolutely heightened responsiveness, so you're alert to every little detail because you know you've got to come up with something. On the other hand, some of the pieces in this book are based on places which I visited and then maybe didn't write anything about them until 7, 8, 9 years later. And I've tended to be a very poor note taker. And so then the pieces tend to move much more into a kind of fiction where, because I can't remember exactly what happened, well, then, you know, you get into that thing of making things up. So it's a real combination of precisely observed stuff about a place and invention. And it's often difficult to say to what extent the place is informing the person looking at it and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. What place out of this book did you just love to be in, where you were enthralled with and you'd love to go back to?
By the end of your life, you want to have been everywhere in the world, mm-hmm. At least once. There's quite a few places in the world you only want to have been to once. But actually, thinking about it, most of the places in this book, I mean, in each of them, something absolutely amazing happened, or I saw something absolutely incredible that made the journey, however inconvenient it might have been, worthwhile. But the whole structure of the book really is geared towards, it doesn't have a conventional narrative as such, but it ends up in this place, Black Rock City, in the Nevada desert. And the whole narrative to the book is a journey towards that place, to my discovery of this place that I regard as home.
You know, we've had other reporters on our show go to Burning Man, the festival of Burning Man, and come back with, you know, all kinds of internal sort of dialogues as what's happened there. Give us your impression. Why do you call this home? Well, you know, what does it bring out in you?
Obviously, it's a great party, this kind of thing, and it's kind of famous the world over for that. But it's also an exemplary place, I think, in that it's somewhere where this huge issue, which I think is so important in our time, of personal freedom combined with civic responsibility, really reaches its highest expression. That is to say, at Burning Man, you're granted something close to absolute freedom, in return for which you've got a promise, you've got a guarantee to be absolutely responsible. So the kind of rubric of the event is, you know, radical self-reliance and radical self-expression. And it's also an idyllic place, as you almost certainly know. Nothing is for sale there. Everything that happens there is something that is brought as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say in the book, Burning Man really raises to a very high level this thing, which this bit of wisdom which we're all in receipt of, which is very easy to know but quite hard to live out, this idea that giving is getting.
Mm-hmm. Do you really you want to see all of this planet? Are you very curious about all of it?
Yeah, I think so, because one of the weird paradoxes of travel is that by leaving your home and traveling, when you do a certain amount of it, weirdly, what you end up feeling is at home everywhere in the world. And the lessons, you know, people often say, so what are the lessons of travel? And in many ways, they're incredibly simple. And one of the really valuable things that you learn is that, well, people are actually pretty decent the world over. It seems to me often that the most paranoid people, the people really worried about getting mugged and getting stuff stolen from them, are people who've hardly ventured outside of their kind of backyard kind of thing. Whereas actually, I mean, given the incredible inequalities of wealth in the world, and given the fact that so many of the places where I've been to in this book, the people are incredibly poor, it's just amazing how honest people are, actually. So I think, I mean, I'm not being really naive. Of course, I'm not. You know, if you said to me, "Hey, we've got a free ticket. You can go to Chechnya," of course I'm not going to go there, because it seems to me I'm, you know, pretty well guaranteed to get kidnapped. But the chances are, if you as an American went to Baghdad now, you'd probably get quite a hospitable welcome, in spite of all the kind of political stuff that's going on. So it makes you have a great fondness for the world, really. It's just an incredible planet, isn't it? And none of the others come within a million miles of it.
So true. Well put. Well, I tell you, I enjoyed it, and I'm sure others will. Our listeners, we're talking to Jeff Dyer, who's just written Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It. And I assume, Jeff, you've never done a day of yoga in your life.
Oh, that's not fair. I've done at least one day of yoga.
One or two. Well, I thank you very much for being here with us, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure.
Next, we take a road trip. Well, it's more of a race than a trip. Actually, it's more of an adventure than a race.
That's the sign?
I don't know. I don't know what the sign is.
There's no sign up.
14 even from the hotel here.
Okay, well, let's do that.
You're late, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay, go.
Can you relate? The Savvy Traveler is produced by Minnesota Public Radio, distributed by Public Radio International. Thank you. You're listening to The Savvy Traveler, Diana Nyad with you here. First, some good news. The monster storm that hammered the Northeast and closed 8 airports is over and done with. Runways are cleared, planes are back in the air, and the tens of thousands of travelers who found themselves stranded have made it to their destinations. But there is bad news, and that is that winter isn't over yet. The storm season is still here. So what should you do if you find your travel plans have been disrupted by bad weather? Well, here to answer that question is our travel expert in residence, Rudy Maxa. Rudy, I understand you were stranded with the bad weather over the weekend.
I was. I was in Chicago for the weekend and expected to come back to my hometown of Washington, D.C. on Monday. And, of course, no airports were open in Washington on Monday. They were snowed in.
So you waited till Tuesday?
I did. But what I did on Monday, as soon as it became obvious I wasn't going to fly out, and this is what every person in this situation should do, is I got myself a seat on a flight, any flight that I thought might be flying. And I figured by Tuesday they'd have them open, or the airports open. So I called United and I said, I need to book a flight for tomorrow. And they said, well, we can't get you out till 6 p.m. There wasn't a confirmed seat available, but I took it because then at least I had a seat in my hand. And then I called the hotel I was staying in, the Four Seasons, and said, I need a room another night now. Then I went out earlier on Tuesday when the airports were open, and I went standby, and I wound up getting on at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. I didn't have to wait till 6 p.m. I went on a standby basis. Now, I must say I'm an elite member of United's frequent flyer programs. So I went to the top of the waiting list line for my particular flight. But I know other people who weren't Premier Executive were getting on as well.
And they didn't have to pay the $25 change fee, huh?
That's right. Now, if a storm comes up suddenly and you can't plan ahead a day as I could, and you're already at the airport, then what you want to do is not stand in line. You want to call the airline's 800 number or your travel agent and have them electronically grab you a seat right away. Once you have your seat, then you're at least in the secure position of knowing you're going to have a flight out at some point, and then you can go on the standby list. Paper tickets aren't a huge advantage over electronic these days. And if you carry a PDA, a personal digital assistant, or you have a cell phone and the airline will send you updates on your flights, all the better.
But Rudy, what do you say you don't get a flight out? What do you expect from the airline? Are they obligated to you because of bad weather?
No, a lot of people think they are, but weather is an exclusionary factor. The airlines can't control that. They're not obligated to put you up overnight. However, many airlines, out of a sense of public relations, will do that. A friend of mine was flying back from Asia, stranded in L.A., trying to get back to Washington, and United gave him 2 hotel nights while he was there. So airlines will attempt to do that, but from the number of news shots we all saw in the 11 o'clock news of people sleeping in airports, obviously not everybody was so lucky.
That's for sure. There were hundreds of them sleeping in airports. Well, Rudy, glad that you got back home safe. And I guess, your constant advice to us is be a pro when you travel. If things are beyond your control, just make the best of it and relax and deal with it.
Weather happens.
All right. Listen, thanks for the advice, and we'll talk to you later in the show and get a deal of the week from you.
Look forward to it.
Let's face it, it doesn't matter how well we plan. Sooner or later, we all end up sleeping in an airport. It's just bound to happen. And you know what? It happened to Rick Lee, a guy who laid down for a nap at San Francisco International and woke up inspired.
I was feeling tired, and I had a garment bag that I brought along. I laid on my garment bag with a suit in it and a hanger and a hair dryer, and upon awakening, I felt this is a neat idea.
Indeed, a neat idea. If only that pesky hair dryer weren't jabbing him in the ribs. But actually, that was Rick's eureka moment, the moment when the Journey Rest inflatable garment bag came to life.
It actually houses a concealed inflatable air mattress, which runs the length of the bag. This mattress serves as a cushion to the hard hangers and accessories in much the same way that an air mattress cushions the rocks on the ground for campers, shall we say.
It sounds comfy. And the lesson we learn from Rick's experience isn't just about napping in airports. It's about making the best of a bad situation when you travel. Just go with the flow, like Rudy said. Maybe invent some inflatable luggage on your own. By the way, the garment bag runs about $200, but just think of the money you'll save on hotels over the years. Let's see. We haven't browsed through the pink folder for quite some time. Let's stuff a bunch of travel ideas in here, kind of fun stuff. Let's see if we can't find something anti-winter. Okay, this promises something here. It says if you're fed up with the worst winter in recent memory, if you want to escape but you're leery of going out of the country right now, have you considered Alaska? Alaska, wait a second. Alaska doesn't usually spring to mind as a wonderful February destination. But they're saying here, while most of the country is frostbitten, Alaskans are out playing golf in their shirt sleeves. They're dealing with mosquitoes and bears months ahead of schedule. You know what? Sounds kind of intriguing. You could be one of the unique travelers to visit Alaska during the winter. I guess they never had.
The Savvy Traveler is supported by Patagonia, maker of outdoor clothing for all your adventures, with a commitment to protecting the natural environment. Patagonia. Heritage, innovation, environment at patagonia.com.
The Travel Industry Association of America reports this week that they're seeing a widespread cutback in international travel this winter and spring. Instead, Americans are planning shorter domestic trips and driving trips, even given rising gas costs. Well, do we have a driving trip for you today? This road trip is sort of in the vein of all these reality television shows. You know the ones. People start out with a few dollars in their pockets, no credit cards at all, and race each other all around the world. Well, this road trip also calls for innovation and successful group dynamics. Now, it might not be your idea of a good time vacation, but our guide, Patricia Murphy, sure got into it.
It's a clear morning in Quesnel, British Columbia. Team TechBug's black 1992 Subaru Legacy Turbo is parked along a dirt forest road near Fraser Lake. I'm crammed in the back of this car with all of our gear, my seat for the next 4,200 miles. Ryan Douthit, a magazine publisher, and Chad Liggett, a machinist, both from Kirkland, Washington, are busy preparing for the day's first timed event. Chad's the team's navigator. It's his job to direct Ryan and keep him on time, according to the route book. But right away, there's a problem.
Yeah, we're tagged.
The guys have somehow driven past the start sign. Ryan quickly pulls a U-turn and heads back the other way, where we run into a fellow rallyist who tries to help us get back on track.
That's the sign?
I don't know what the sign is.
There's no sign up.
Even from the hotel here.
Okay, well, let's do that.
You're late, aren't you?
Yeah.
There you go.
For the next 10 minutes, Ryan drives like a maniac trying to catch up. At day's end, the team score is an 18, meaning they were 18 seconds off the perfect time. Not bad, considering Ryan and Chad have only done four rallies together.
I got a craving love for blazing speed, got a hopped up Mustang Ford.
After a long day on the road, Al Canners immediately head to the bar. Call a rally a race in this crowd, and you're going to find trouble. See, a rally is not about going fastest over a stretch of road. Instead, it's precision. Going from one checkpoint to the next closest to an allotted amount of time. Staged sections are called TSDs for time speed distance. Rallyist and software engineer Steve Willey says the nearly 5,000-mile Alcan event is like the biathlon, where athletes run or ski and then do precision marksmanship.
You know, by the ninth day, you're pretty ragged, yet you still have to focus tightly on these numbers, on these speeds, on this driving. It's about being on time. It's about driving precisely and covering tons of miles and being exactly where you should be at the exact right time. You often find a lot of accountants, lawyers, people that have a keen focus on details. It's a geek sport.
1,800 miles into the rally, we're winding up the Cassiar Highway on our way to Skagway, Alaska. What used to be pavement is now a dirt road running through a vast wilderness with almost no signs of civilization. By the time we reach Skagway, Chad and Ryan are frustrated. Computer problems have plagued them for the past 2 days.
On the way up to Whitehorse, at some point, the odometer on our rally computer just stopped.
Skagway, Alaska owes its existence to the Klondike Gold Rush. These days, it lives and breathes around the cruise ship industry. Just last week, 34,000 people funneled through here. But today is Saturday, and we've got the town to ourselves. While the guys work on their technical problems, the rest of us head to the bar. The mood's high, and we're bonding over martinis, beer, and rally stories. There's the one about the kindly Canadian Mountie, who years ago helped a team track down moose antlers to mount on their car, brains attached. Ugh. Then Don Beck chimes in. Don's working on a documentary about the Alcan.
This might be the most classic motorcycle story of all time. One of the riders, he's been having trouble with his motorcycle all week long. So his partner drives up ahead of him, and he stops at some out-of-the-way little gas station to gas up and fix the electrical problem to his bike. And he takes off his helmet, and he lays his helmet next to the motorcycle while he's futzing around with it. So he's futzing around. All of a sudden, he hears, psst, and he turns around, and some dog is urinating not only on the helmet, inside of the helmet. And so for the last 2 days, he has gone through, let's see, hairspray. He poured aqua velva in it, tried lighter fluid. He's tried baking soda. He's tried everything. And he's got a helmet, basically, that has dog urine in it that he now has to drive another 3,000 miles in.
Stay all night, stay a little longer. Dance all night, dance a little longer. Pull off your coat, throw it in the corner. Don't see why you ain't stay a little longer.
At 6:30 the next morning, many of the Alcanners, myself included, look as thick and foggy as the cloud cover that's descended on Skagway. The fog remains as we begin the day's first TSD. I'm feeling queasy and a little hungover as Ryan, Chad, and I wind out of town via the Carcross Highway. Ryan speeds past giant RVs as he tries to stay on time. The RV passengers watch us, their faces petrified in fright. I glance in the mirror and realize I look exactly the same. 30 minutes later, the TSD is over and Ryan and Chad seem satisfied. I have them pull over. I need to throw up. I return to the car, and the guys hand me a tissue and a can of Sprite to settle my stomach. Nice guys. We soon pass into the Northwest Territory and stop to fill up. A motorcycle pulls in, and I chat up the driver, Rob Hughes, from Goulburn, England. Turns out he's running in a completely different rally, the Nick Sanders Motorcycle World Challenge. 25,000 miles in 3 months.
We started off on the 6th of August, New York, come up to Niagara, come across Canada. We've been into...
Rob's red-rimmed eyes stand out against his face, which looks tanned, but is actually caked with dust from riding endless dirt roads. They're going around the world.
From then, we're going over to Istanbul, coming through Eastern Europe, over into North Africa, before ending up in London where we finish.
On day 6... we totaled the car. We begin the day traveling along the noisy gravel of the old Alaska highway. We've got a 500-mile drive to Yellowknife, and Ryan's in a hurry. So after a quick lunch stop at a small Inuit gas station, we leave the group behind. Ryan and Chad are singing as we head out.
A yellow submarine, a yellow submarine, a yellow submarine. Shall I pass? We all live in a yellow submarine. Submarine, that's a rise. A yellow submarine. Ah, we're all gonna die.
I settle in and soon fall asleep, but my rest is fitful. Nightmare visions of lap belt injuries stream by, and I wake up just to reposition my shoulder belt. What seems like a second later, we hit a berm of dirt in the road. We slide, spin out, then completely roll over, landing right side up in a bog. Covered in glass, I carefully crawl out of the car. Chad and I are bruised, but fine. Ryan, on the other hand, is bleeding profusely from his head. Another team pulls up. Ryan gets in, and they drive off to the hospital 6 hours away. Our car is destroyed. The gargantuan highway trucks continue on their way. They don't even stop. Still in shock, I hop into another rally car and continue on to Yellowknife. There I learn this road is called the Highway of Death because it's so rugged and remote. Over the years, there have been 5 major wrecks on the Alcan 5000. I'm feeling really lucky.
When I got to the house, I called you out. I could tell you've been crying.
Rally accidents are not taken lightly. Everyone's concerned and more than a little rattled. With Ryan and Chad out, I have to ride with some of the other teams. So on day 7, I head out with Team Subaru. Ardell Krosar won this rally in the past. He's an ex-Marine, and to him, rallying is very serious business. But as is often the case in these events, Things quickly go awry.
We've passed it. It's here. We must be lost.
This is the co-driver, Ken Eklund.
We're on Airport Road. We might have missed the turn onto Old Airport Road.
Everyone in the car is incredibly tense as Ardale guns it through morning traffic in Yellowknife. My heart is in my throat.
2 miles. We're guys. I mean, we're a mile off the damn thing.
I'm not watching the mileage turns.
As the clock ticks, it's continually moving down the road.
The problem is we're on Airport Road. The instruction before this was bear right on Old Airport Road. I think we missed that one.
I think we did.
When you go back, you're essentially tripling the amount of penalty.
There's Peter.
I couldn't see a sign.
There's Peter. There's
there wasn't a sign saying Old Airport Road. There wasn't a sign.
There's Gary.
Oh, 83.
Guys,
help me out here. Well, guys, we weren't even to that mileage yet.
I'm not watching the mileage.
It was 1 mile plus that milepost. I had just misread the number. It was that simple of an error. So we had been going the right way all along.
What's going on? Can you read the damn clock?
I'm sorry. I was a mile early. That's the mistake. So we're on course. I was a mile early.
Ardell's driving skill is impressive, and soon we're on our way to Grand Prairie. I can breathe again. That afternoon, I tag along with the other Alcan favorites, Gary Webb and Team Atlantic. Where the morning was organized and all business, Team Atlantic is the opposite. Their rental car is loaded with electronics, a rally computer, CV, ham radio, a global positioning unit so friends back home can track their progress. During long hauls, Gary plays CB trivia on the radio. He munches on red vines and listens to the 1812 Overture.
You're supposed to be here to run the rally as best as you possibly can, to try to stay in time as best as you possibly can, and to have a vacation. And that's the most important thing. Checkpoint coming up on the left. Checkpoint on the left.
Yeah, right. There he is.
See it? All right. On day one, you got to come here to be on vacation. You got to come here to have a good time and have fun. If you think that winning the $10 trophy at the end is why you're here, then you should have bought the $10 trophy and stayed the hell home. Because, you know, it's way too much work to try to win a $10 trophy.
In the end, Gary's strategy pays off. Team Atlantic takes first place. The other Alcanners, including Ryan and Chad, all gather at the finish in Jasper, Alberta to celebrate. Altogether, there are numerous speeding tickets, one totaled car, one motorcycle crash, 5 stitches in Ryan's head, and 1 broken wrist. The winners accept framed photographs of sacred rock formations, but in the end, it's not about winning. It's the amazing adventure and the camaraderie. I hit my 5,000th mile on my way back home. As we cross the international border, I'm struck, not by the distances we've traveled, but by how deeply affected I've been by some meaningless road race. I don't know if it was the accident or spending 12 hours a day inside my own head, but I've made some decisions, some really serious ones about my life and how I want to live it. The world seems much more vast than it was just 10 days ago. So I'll probably never do another rally. I'm sort of a reckless driver, not to mention the motion sickness. But months after the rally's end, I'm still holding on to it. That intensity is what brings the Alcanners back year after year. It's more than a break from monotony. The rally gives you a sense of clarity that's hard to find in day-to-day life. You have clear goals, an automatic community, a real sense of control that most of us have a hard time finding. The Alcan taught me that in order to be happy, really happy, I need to find my own break. It's like Gary said, it's not about that $10 trophy, whatever that $10 trophy might be. I need to follow my heart, feed my soul, find adventure each and every day. Back in Seattle, for now, I'm Patricia Murphy for Savvy Traveler.
Next up, a new regular joins the Savvy Traveler. He's going to make the things that went wrong on your trip right. Things like this.
I talked to her for quite a while. She eventually said that she'd only charge us for one night, but I got my bill, and they, in fact, charged us for all 3 nights.
Our new Fix My Trip segment kicks off today. Get satisfaction. Get even. get in to fix my trip. The Savvy Traveler is produced by Minnesota Public Radio, distributed by PRI. This is The Savvy Traveler. I'm Diana Nyad, and Rudy's back with us now for his deal of the week. Rudy, what have you got for us this week?
Well, you know, renting a car in Europe can be very expensive, and I'm not just talking about the gasoline. But if you're planning a trip to Europe this year and you'll need a car for 17 days or more, don't rent, lease your car.
Huh.
Both Renault and Peugeot have deals that will deliver you a brand new car in several different sizes, from subcompact to minivan, at a great price.
Well, you say a great price, so, you know, what is such a good deal about it, and what's the difference, really, between renting and leasing?
It's some kind of legal technicality, but it works in the consumer's favor. If you lease a car instead of renting one, you avoid paying the value-added tax on that rental, which in France, for example, is 19.6%.
Oh, yeah, it's huge.
You get a new car, you get unlimited mileage, and insurance, another expensive item in Europe, all included in the price. Let me give you an example. Renault Eurodrive will lease you a little tiny car, the Twingo 1.2. It's got automatic transmission and air conditioning for 17 days for $749. Now, that works out to $44 a day, but every day thereafter costs only $18. So you rent one of those for 6 weeks, or you lease one of those, I should say, and you pay $29 a day.
Excellent price.
Now, there are two tips. Book early. For example, Europe by Car rents new Peugeots, but they ask you to book 4 or 5 weeks in advance. You can book shorter, but to be sure you get the car you want at the price you want, you ought to book way ahead. Now, if you book a car from Renault Eurodrive for any time this year before the end of March, they'll give you a discount. Here's the example. A Laguna 2 sedan that normally costs $1,299 for 17 days will cost you $150 less if you book by the end of March. And your extra day rate will be $23 a day instead of $25.
Now, in which countries are these offers valid?
They're available in most Western European countries, some more than others. For example, Renault Eurodrive only has one location in the UK. It's near London's Heathrow Airport. But for specific cities where you can pick up and drop off these cars, check the 800 numbers or the websites for Renault Eurodrive or Europe by Car that I'm going to post on SavvyTraveler.org. Now, there may be drop-off charges if you rent a car in one country and need to return it in another. One footnote, you can't lease a car for longer than 6 months under these programs.
Okay, so it's between 17 days and 6 months. Really good advice for people planning an extended vacation in Europe. Thank you so much, Rudy Maxa, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye, Diana. See you then.
If you're going to be needing a car in Europe but won't be driving for the 17 days minimum to make Rudy's lease deal work for you, Hertz is adding an extra day to a one-week rental. Now, that's if you make your reservation by March 31st and pick up your car by June 30th. We'll put links to that deal up on our site, SavvyTraveler.org. We'll post this one, too. Alamo Rent-A-Car initiated a new bonus this week. Vacationers want to keep in touch with friends and family while they're traveling overseas, especially these days. Well, Alamo will now offer all customers from the U.S. and Canada free international cell phones with each car they rent. That goes for travels in Europe, Asia, Middle East, Africa. Now, you still have to pay for your calls, but renting the phone itself abroad can cost as much as $8 a day. A free cell phone is a perk that really makes sense in these times of heightened security concerns.
If you want to trade tips with other savvy travelers or find details about anything you've heard on the show, our website address is savvytraveler.org. Transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available by calling 1-800-777-TEXT or by visiting our website, savvytraveler.org. The Savvy Traveler also provides content to CNN.com.
Seems like everyone has a travel horror story, whether you've lost your luggage or your tour operator has gone bankrupt in the middle of your trip. And I'll tell you, around here, based on the amount of email we get from frustrated travelers, it's just a wonder we don't all stay home. Well, we feel your pain. We really do. We know that resolving travel snafus can be just maddening. You get the runaround from the airline. Your letters go unanswered. Customer service is a joke, a bad one at that. And that's why this week we're launching a new segment called Fix My Trip.
For customer relations, press
4. The woman at the front desk said that
they told me that my miles were completely wiped out.
Found out that my flight time
please select from one of the following four options.
For them to bill us as they see fit.
They won't rectify it.
Fix my trip, please.
Here's the way Fix My Trip works. You have a problem with a trip, you tell us about it, and we fix it. Or, to be more accurate about that, our new travel troubleshooter, Christopher Elliott, fixes it. Chris is the ombudsman for National Geographic Traveler magazine, and he now becomes our fix-it man. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Diana.
We're just so happy to have you. You've got a great track record at National Geo. Do you suppose you're going to be able to fix trips for our folks as well?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I know you're into one already. What have you been working on for this week?
Well, Kimberly Farley in Seattle had a problem with a hotel, a problem that stems from conflicting views of what modern means.
Modern. Okay, I'm intrigued. I guess that's where the whole problem came about with that word. We've got Kimberly on the line. Kimberly, how are you?
Fine.
Good. Tell us your story quickly.
Well, my husband and I decided to go down to New Orleans for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed at a very nice hotel for 3 days and wanted to move to a different part of New Orleans for the actual Christmas day. We were looking for kind of a fancy hotel to stay in over Christmas Day.
Okay.
We were trying to go to a place called the International House,
mm-hmm.
But I found that they were booked up. So in speaking to the person on the phone from the International House, they said that they had another hotel that they could set me up with called the Loft.
Okay.
They said that it was very sleek and very modern.
Yeah, what was the picture there?
Well, the place was kind of chilly. The floor was cement, and it was not covered with anything.
No rugs at all?
No rugs
cement
at all.
Cement floor. Ooh, that is cold. What else?
All of the walls were white, and they didn't have any paintings on them. There was sparse furniture. It was really a bed, a big television, a small writing table, and a straight-back chair. So we went downstairs and told them this was not at all what we had imagined and that we weren't going to stay there. The woman at the front desk said that we were going to be charged for all 3 nights. I talked to her for quite a while. She eventually said that she'd only charge us for 1 night, but I got my bill, and they, in fact, charged us for all 3 nights.
Oh, they did. And have you called them, and they won't rectify it?
They won't rectify it. That was $300 a night.
With $300 a night, and you didn't stay 1 night there?
Not
wow.
at all.
So, Chris, first of all, can they do that?
Yeah, they can. A lot of hotels have policies like that so that if guests like Kimberly have a sudden change of plans, they don't lose the revenue that they were expecting. But, you know, I can't believe the International House would send you to a property like the Loft, which is a world away from the International House. When your hotel found out that you didn't like your accommodations, it really shouldn't have charged your credit card anything. After all, you made that reservation based on a recommendation by a hotel staff member. The Loft should have helped you find a room that you liked, either at the International House or elsewhere in town.
What could Kimberly have done differently?
Yeah, I would have asked around before making that booking, you know, tried to find a more reliable source of information than a hotel employee. You shouldn't confuse a staff member's advice for that of a travel agent or even a word-of-mouth recommendation from a friend.
Yeah, sounds right. So how did you fix this trip, Chris?
Yeah, I contacted Amy Reimer, the hotel's general manager, and I told her about what had happened. She apologized for the misunderstanding, and she refunded your entire charge, Kimberly. And she invited you back to New Orleans, this time to the International House, for a free two-night visit.
That's amazing. Thank you so much.
That is amazing. It's beyond the call of duty, really.
Yes.
All right. Well, listen, I'm glad you're happy with the results here. Chris Elliott, great work.
No problem.
All right. Now, you're going to be joining us on the show in the coming weeks to fix a lot more trips. And as I said before, we have tons of listeners with trips in need of fixing. So how can they contact you, Chris?
You can send me an email at fixmytrip@savvytraveler.org. I can't promise a happy ending, but I'll give it a shot.
Well, for some reason, I foresee a number of happy endings here with this segment. Fix My Trip, Christopher Elliott, thank you very much. And Kimberly Farley, thank you.
Thank you.
Sound travels. It's that time in our show when we just sit back and let our ears do the traveling. In February 2001, Jeff Greenwald found himself in Kathmandu, Nepal, in the middle of one of the biggest parties in the city. An annual festival is held every year in honor of the Hindu god Shiva, recognized as the creator and destroyer of the world. The temple grounds fill with musicians and worshippers who come to honor Shiva and pray that he destroy all the evil in their lives and in the world. Jeff took in the colors, the smells, and, of course, with his microphone, the sounds and the music. Next week on The Savvy Traveler, you know you're hella skiing when the ride up is just as scary as the ride down. And there's only one thing on your mind scarier than either.
The helicopter hovers above an improvised landing zone on a knife-edge ridge. But before we are allowed to plunge into nothingness, our guide Kurt cautions us about sloth. That small avalanche is chasing you down a hill.
A trip to the fabled slopes of Valdez, Alaska. That's next week on The Savvy Traveler. The Savvy Traveler is produced by Benjamin Adair, Josh Berman, Jim Gates, John Holt, Amir Kennan, Derry London, David Lott, and Kelly Markham. Jim Russell's the general manager of Marketplace Productions, and the executive producer of The Savvy Traveler is J.J. Yore. I'm Diana Nyad. See all you travelers again next week.
The Savvy Traveler is produced in Los Angeles by Minnesota Public Radio in association with the University of Southern California. On the web at savvytraveler.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.